Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we've got a lot to deal with this week. It's going to be pretty much a Ukraine-focused episode, as folks might imagine. But before we dive into that, what are we drinking?
I am drinking a really delightful red blend, but really more importantly, I'm drinking it out of one of my new vintage glassware glasses that I bought myself for my 10-year wedding anniversary. That point,
living
I just
your best
made,
life.
Yep. Point I just made right there is basically a key to a happy marriage. Buy it yourself.
Radha, on the West Coast, what do we have this morning?
I am drinking a very large cup of coffee, but in a very exciting mug because it has a sticker that my team made to have our own little sticker brand, which was very exciting. But I'm also looking forward to, today is the Blessing of the Animals Day by St. Francis. So we're going to a winery to have our dog breath blessed, see a giant turtle, and drink much wine. So I think that'll be an excellent afternoon.
Man, you guys are really doing it right. Yeah. I'm on my second cup of coffee. This is my last episode in Los Angeles, guys. How exciting is that?
My goodness.
And the best part about that will be that I can now revert to recording at noon and not 9 a.m.
Yeah.
9 a.m. is not my best time of day. And so I am on iced coffee from Two Guns, which I went out and obtained at 7 o'clock this morning, right when they opened, because we love you all so much that we get up early to prepare for these podcasts.
I can wake you up at 5:30 in the morning if you want.
It really is unfair. I mean, Radha and I have been awake since like the sun came up because of children. But then we get to prepare for a lot longer in the morning. And by the time we are here, like cheery and happy.
I don't do cheery and happy at the best of times. So anywho, all right. We have a lot to get through and we've debated kind of how we wanted to handle this episode because obviously a lot has happened since we last chatted with each other. First, though, can we just take a note of like all the things that we're not going to talk about because we're going to focus on Ukraine and impeachment and all the ways in which that takes over our lives? And maybe this is a metaphor for what happens in the White House or in other places when there are brewing domestic political crises and you can't pay attention to the rest of the world.
Let's do it.
Radha, what are we missing on your front?
Guys, we just imposed a bunch of tariffs on the EU, which in addition to the hilarity of whiskey and red wine, scotch and red wine being taxed, there's a whole mess of trade stuff that I just couldn't.
That sounds bad.
On the Syria front, Turkey has said that it has the right to take over eastern Syria, redrawing property lines and settling 1 million people there. So, you know, that's a normal weekend for everybody in the Middle East.
Yeah, so that's sort of just a minor, maybe like a minor invasion of northern Syria
right.
by the Turks,
yep.
You know, as you do. There were pretty substantial protests in Baghdad over the week this week and potential brewing political instability there. Also no big deal, you know, just the usual business. And speaking of minor political instability, the Brits are about to set, if they had a paper constitution, they'd be setting it on fire. Right, I think where we currently are at is that Boris Johnson and the Queen are playing chicken with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically dared Liz to fire him. So meanwhile, that sounds like fun. And they're what, like 3.5 weeks out from their Brexit date on Halloween, of course. So these are all really important things that not only do we not have time to talk about, it's potentially the case that no one in Washington has time to focus on any of these things because everyone is being deposed by either an inspector general or a House committee or their own personal attorneys.
Right.
And we're going to get into all of that. So I thought it might be helpful if we started off with kind of just some really general background on the Ukraine. Does that work for you guys?
Yes.
Yeah.
Starting with, don't say the Ukraine.
That's right. Mm. Not the Ukraine.
Nope.
It is just Ukraine. And my favorite about this is whenever you Google like timelines online, there's, you know, CNN has something that started like 20 minutes ago. And then, you know, Vox has something that's like the last 3 years. And you can always rely on the BBC to be like, in the 9th century AD, the blah, blah, blah group invaded blah, blah, blah. And
so
we now have this, you know, whatever. And that's literally how the BBC timeline starts. We're not going to go quite back that far. But one of the things that's really important to understand, I think, about current Ukrainian politics is how contested the territory of Ukraine has been throughout the 20th century. And so Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire for a very long time. They declared their independence in 1918, following the collapse of the Russian Empire. They're then conquered by the Red Army and become part of the Soviet Union in 1921 as part of the Russian Civil War. This is not a pleasant period. There's a massive famine that kills millions of Ukrainians as part of Stalin's collectivization program. And then to cap that all off, they're occupied by the Nazis for most of World War II. This is not good. Again, millions of Ukrainians die fighting the Nazi army, roll back into the Soviet Union. We're not going to get into the details of the Soviet history here, but by 1991, Ukraine declares independence again, for real this time. The politics of kind of the post-Soviet period are pretty fascinating. Stephen Solnik stealing the state and some other things are very interesting. One piece here that folks have referenced previously that I think is worth recapping here is the Budapest Memorandum. So it turns out after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a significant number of nuclear weapons were left in the Ukraine, and as part of handing them over and Ukraine ascending to the non-proliferation regime as an NPT non-nuclear weapon state, multiple countries provided security assurances to Ukraine in exchange for them turning over those weapons. So they handed the nuclear weapons back to the state of Russia. And the U.S., U.K., France, and China each made various security assurances. So that's 1994, kind of gets us into something like the status quo proper. But the efforts of democratic consolidation throughout the 1990s and the 2000s are somewhat fraught. And like many of the post-Soviet regimes and East European regimes are dominated by oligarchs. And this leads to sort of just endemic corruption and people seeking personal enrichment through capturing various elements of the state enterprise. Folks might remember the Orange Revolution, which takes place in 2004, which ousts the pro-Russian Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. But it's not the last that we'll hear from him. He comes back in 2010, and Radha's going to hopefully bring us up to speed a little bit on that. But I think one of the things that's important to realize is both the geography of Ukraine as it sits right between Russia and the kind of former Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe. The Crimean Peninsula provides essentially Russian access to a warm water port, which is a longstanding Russian strategic goal. They don't have a lot of warm water ports. It turns out it's really hard to move ships in and out of cold water ports because, you know, things are frozen. So there's a strategic imperative to the territory of Ukraine, but there's also a political one. And so since independence 1991, Ukraine has really kind of toggled back and forth between more pro-Russia disposition and seeing its future as being appropriately allied with Russia, and those who have pushed for a more pro-European orientation, either in pursuit of accession to NATO or certainly some sort of accommodation with the EU. And that's really what kind of triggers the Maidan Revolution in 2013. So, Radha, if we want to shift into keeping up foreign relations, does that give you enough kind of context to help us figure out what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years?
It sure does. And I think what might be helpful is actually to just bucket Ukraine stuff into 3 categories.
I love a good bucket.
You do, though you hate my multiple buckets. So, but say love you. I'll do me.
Press on.
So the first is economic issues. The second is some intersection of political and security issues, and I'll come back to that. And the third is actually the energy sector. And it turns out that the current events are amazing confluence of these 3 issues that have happened over time. So let's start with the security and political stuff, because that's kind of just tease off of what you just said, Aaron. So Yanukovych, who you mentioned, was ousted in 2014 in this sort of like, let's call it a popular uprising. I'm using air quotes, guys. It was a transition of power. And so this guy Poroshenko takes over, and more relevant for us is there's this Ukrainian general prosecutor, Shokinas. My Russian names are terrible. I'm sorry. And so Shokin is basically largely seen as problematic by lots of people, including the U.S. and the Obama administration at the time, but also the Europeans and also the IMF and sort of international economic stuff. So let me now shift over to economic stuff. As Aaron mentioned, corruption, not great in Ukraine, true for much of its sort of Eastern European brethren as well. And so there are a lot of efforts to try to induce more transparency and less corruption through a range of different economic support from the U.S. and Europeans, including these loan guarantees.
And those were also often like a condition of if you want greater participation in the EU or you want formal membership or some other sort of arrangement, you have to clean up these, you know, this sort of endemic corruption and have essentially like an actual rule of law where contracts can be enforced, et cetera.
Correct. And a lot of this corruption stemmed from transitioning from socialized economies to market economies, which was part of what was happening sort of in the 2000s. So here we have these loan guarantees and a sort of general pressure campaign. Biden was engaged in it, but so were the Europeans and so was the IMF, trying to sort of push the Ukrainians to crack down more on corruption, get rid of their sucky Shokin prosecutor, get someone else in there who could really take on corruption. And during that period of pressure, which is happening in sort of 2014, 2015, Hunter Biden joins the board of an energy company in Ukraine. And now let me shift over to energy very quickly. So as Aaron mentioned, Ukraine geographically sits in this space between Europe and Russia. And that means, funny thing about the energy sector, the lines and energy technology can vary depending on where you are in the European geography. So Ukraine is actually more, its energy sector is actually more strongly linked to Russian technology and the Russian grid than to the European grid. And that has a lot of relevance for their energy sources, for nuclear plants, which use Russian technology rather than European technology. And all of that means that these energy companies in Ukraine end up being both run by oligarchs and of sort of a lot of political interest generally, both for their revenue purposes, but also in this discussion of marketizing the Ukrainian economy and dealing with corruption and sort of becoming a better player in the European setting. So all of that leads us to this, and then I'll sort of pause and we can talk about security assistance because I think Lauren is also knows a good amount about some of the process pieces here, which is the U.S. sort of shifts in 2014 from this focus on economic assistance to doing more military assistance. And that's
note that that's because the Russians invaded Crimea in 2014, which we sort of glossed over just a minute ago.
Right.
Minor detail.
They annexed Crimea. Right.
And there's been ongoing fighting in other parts of Ukraine. A low-level invasion, you know, as happens.
And I think Russia just likes Crimea because of aforementioned water ports, right? There's like a weird, Ukraine is kind of geographically laid out weird and Crimea is like only attached by this little peninsula. So it's pretty easy
it's to important.
Cut off. So we shift to start doing military assistance. So just, I think there was a recent Congressional Budget Office report that says at this point, we spent about $1.5 billion with a B on military assistance to Ukraine. And this largely until the Trump administration was sort of lower level weapons, sniper rifles, maybe some RPGs, but largely intended to be defensive and logistical support rather than offensive weaponry or sort of at least a more aggressive defensive weaponry like javelins, which are sort of anti-tank weapons. So all of that aid goes through these processes that we have in the U.S. where when you want to give aid to a country, you put together a package if you're at the Department of Defense and you talk about what the aid you're going to give and the justification for it. And then you notify Congress, who has appropriated a total amount of money for spending under a particular authority. And you tell them, hey, we're planning to spend this amount of money to do these things for this country. And in this case, the Department of Defense notified Congress twice, once in February for $250 million, which was for sniper rifles and counterartillery ammo, some grenade launchers. And then again in May for $141 million for a bunch of maritime security stuff and like NATO interoperability. I say this because this is not very exciting aid in and of itself, but right, it's not like we're sending them giant aircraft.
Foreign military sales are riveting, Radha. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
It's not very exciting, but it is kind of it was a big political point because of a point you made earlier about for a long time, the bulk of the aid that we were providing to them was either non-lethal or very defensive in nature. And there was a huge resistance in the Obama administration to going further steps towards offensive capabilities to provide to Ukrainians. because there was a view that this would be a huge red flag for the Russians, both at like red flag in terms of a this is a problem, but also red flag in terms of a like there is a bull waiting to run against the bullfighter waving a red flag.
And I do think maybe we can just pause here for a second. I think it's easy to forget how disruptive or what a sea change the Russian annexation of Crimea was in terms of Russian relationships with the United States and with the rest of kind of the Western world, right? So Russia is, they're kicked out of the G7 as a result of this, right? Yep. There are multiple levels of sanctions imposed, not just by the United States, but by, there's a lot of lobbying by the U.S. to get European allies, especially the Germans, to impose things as well. I mean, this is really, you know, whatever reset we had been trying to pursue, you know, with the Russians previously, especially under Medvedev, that is gone. And the current kind of relationship with Russia at a geopolitical level is really set, I feel, by their annexation of Crimea and the kind of fallout from that. So,
right.
I think that's right. It's also worth just saying it also changed how we relate to Ukraine, right? Because previously, yes, all of our engagements with Ukraine were largely focused, similar to other Eastern European countries, on things like corruption and economic integration and some democratic processes. They really weren't focused on the military side. And similarly, our energy engagements weren't focused on securing their energy infrastructure, or giving them alternate energy sources. I don't mean that in like renewable energy. I mean things that don't depend on Russians.
Right.
And that all changed as we move into 2015 and 2016 in the Obama administration, and then really changed with the Trump administration. So maybe I'll just like sort of close out with, so this call and the relevance of the call and the discussion is sort of threefold. One,
the call with President Zelensky.
Correct. The call with President Zelensky, that the transcript has now been released by the White House and sort of provides actually a lot of information about the overall relationship of what had been going on. So one is Ukraine has become pretty reliant on these regular amounts of military assistance for these various kinds of military aid, like rifles and interoperability systems and so forth. And so even slowing down that aid was something that was really noticed, right? So they're like getting a little agitated because they actually need it to continue their sort of campaign to keep relative stability in parts of eastern Ukraine. And you can tell that that's why they're kind of trying to get this aid released. And that's why there are so many questions about it. The second thing is Trump and his folks actually have had a lot of engagement with various parts of Ukraine on different issues. And similarly, so have the Biden folks, right? And so the Biden folks have this engagement with on the investigations and prosecutions with Hunter Biden on this energy board. Trump's folks have Manafort's campaign and Ukrainian ties with Yanukovych, remember him, and his political party. And then the Trump administration itself is now trying to pressure Ukraine to investigate under this rubric of corruption discussion. And Ukraine is really pushing back. And the third thing is just Rick Perry, who was invoked at the 11th hour, reminds us that a huge part of what we've been trying to do with Ukraine in terms of building resilience relates to resiliency in their energy sector, because we don't want Russia to get undue leverage over them with things like their reliance on Russian fuel for nuclear power plants or their reliance on the Russian grid and energy production. And that's why this liquefaction issue is relevant at all from the Energy Department, which just, I had totally forgotten, Rick Perry is in charge of.
But he totally is. So I think that's a pretty good summary, at least on the Ukrainian side. And as we kind of flagged, I think last time, I mean, they really are in a rock and a hard place. They cannot afford to alienate the U.S. administration, regardless of who is running it. And it turns out that the people running it, and we can talk about this a little bit in White House Mayhem, are actually convinced that the Ukrainians play an important role in the, basically in the flip side and the counter narrative of the 2016 election interference. And that basically, I think Hillary Clinton's email servers are in Ukraine somewhere, or I mean, there's a deep conspiracy theory that clearly really Rudy Giuliani and others have pushed, and the members of the White House seem to believe that the Ukrainians play a really important role in understanding what actually happened in 2016. And so that is sort of the alternative universe that key members of White House staff are pursuing, and then gets tied up with all of these other very detailed foreign policy pursuits.
I will also say, like, I think what's super interesting is our oversight procedures are actually useful in kind of highlighting this. Part of the reason Congress was kind of animated and trying to find out what was wrong is because they had a reason. There's also the whistleblower track, which is a separate discussion, but the Department of Defense had notified Congress of its intent to disperse these funds through this aid. And then, like, there's a notification period and then it's over. And then typically the disbursement happens, right? And you send over the aid. And it didn't. And everyone's kind of like, what's going on? Like, where did this go? Why is this, what's happening here? And there are questions on sort of all sides trying to figure out what's going on with the Ukrainian aid and why is it being held up?
And we have answers to those questions now, and they are not good. Anything else you want to say here to wrap up kind of the Ukrainian domestic politics piece of keeping up foreign relations? And then we're going to shift gears slightly and I think do talk about a little bit of trade and how that also links into some of this.
I think one final point on this, we discussed the election of President Zelensky, I guess, several months ago and back in April, mm-hmm. March, April. And just as a reminder to folks, he is not a career politician or a bureaucrat. He did not at the time, as we said, come in with a lot of directly stated foreign policy views in some way. And in some ways that allowed him to be something of a blank slate for the White House to take advantage of.
Okay. So meanwhile, we know we have, you know, transcripts now and text messages indicating the president of the United States has pressured President Zelensky and others to conduct investigations into his political rivals. He's also pulled China into this mix, Radha, and that's part of a much, I don't know, it's just freaking briar patch over there on the trade side. What's going on?
Just to remind folks, we are supposed to be restarting these talks with China next week. There was a pause in the next round of tariffs where we thought we'd all get back together, chit chat, hopefully, you know, come with a deal. And if not, tariffs go from 25 to 30% on about $250 billion of goods. So that happens October 15th. So that's just like the background setting now in which Trump, you know, starts doing things like asking Beijing to investigate Biden's dealings in China. And also tells them they're doing a bang up job on those Hong Kong protests. And it's sort of become a little bit of a question of how linked are these issues at this point, especially sort of in the shadow of the Ukraine deal, where it appears pretty clear that the administration was willing to hold back aid and was willing to adjust its sort of policy in response to political issues and political, I really mean like election politics. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a real question both in the minds in Beijing and in sort of folks who are interested in trade issues on how much of an issue are sort of the Trump administration and political appointees sort of focus on electoral issues, how much of that is going to drive their willingness to cut a deal with Beijing. And I could see this going in two directions. Like on the one hand, the Trump administration and Beijing do not appear to have been that close together. Folks might remember before when they were close to a trade deal, or we thought we were, and then it went over to Chinese leadership and they looked at it and sent back a heavily redlined document.
Indeed.
So I don't think we're like on the brink of an agreement. And so maybe this won't put us over. On the other hand, China is not, you know, we're not negotiating with a democratic partner here. And so the extent to which China is or isn't willing to sort of mix across a lot of streams remains open. And that's kind of terrifying because we don't have the same sort of shared set of norms and agreements where China might be able to push back in different ways. And China, we don't have a good sense of Chinese willingness to sort of trade political dirt, for example, for economic relief. And if that's the case, then we might be in a very different situation than the Ukrainian. So we'll see. It's also just worth noting that, you know, the jobs report came out last week and we hit the lowest unemployment in a long time at 3.5%. And we added some new jobs. But as a lot of the discussion focused, these are all lag indicators that sort of capture the economic conditions prior to the imposition of taxes or these trade taxes on consumer goods. And measures like consumer spending and confidence measures are really down precipitously since the consumer good tariffs have come into effect. So there's also this question on like what will be the follow-on economic effects in these spaces, and how is that going to impact the politics space as well. So everything is a mess. And I'll just close out by saying, you know, there's a million things we could talk on this Chinese, the Chinese overlap of issues. Brookings Cafeteria, which is a podcast, has like a really excellent set of interviews with Lindsay Ford covering everything from the tariffs and economic sort of economic policy overlaps to Chinese overseas basing efforts. And it is both extremely illuminating and terrifying. So I would just say we don't have time to cover it, but those interviews cover a lot of kind of how I had been thinking about it as well.
Awesome. I think one of the things that caught my ear when I heard that the president had basically said that, you know, President Xi should also investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and look for corruption is that this is a regime that is actually currently engaged in arbitrary detention against various diplomats or near diplomats from allied countries. I mean, there's a Canadian diplomat or recent diplomat who's, I think, still imprisoned in China. And so it's actually quite an extraordinary invitation to open up, you know, to suggest that an adversary regime target your political opponents, given their actual history of, you know,
targeting political opponents
and, you know, these sorts of things. So, and then of course, Radha, as you note, the Hong Kong protests are going on as well. And there's been, you know, very little public support from them from the White House. It's unclear to me similarly, like if there's been any, like what the quid pro quo would look like, you know, sort of there, but certainly they don't feel like there's any great cost to their relationship with the United States for pursuing that. So, I mean, I think that that's more complicated than that in Hong Kong because the Beijing government is not directly engaged exactly, but hard to say. Lots to unpack there. I mean, this whole episode has sort of been White House mayhem, but we'll formally shift into White House mayhem. And I think one of the things that we can sort of start with is some reporting on other White House leadership calls. The Washington Post had a pretty detailed rundown of, I don't know, I guess sort of maybe what we've always thought has been happening with the White House calls to foreign leaders. Very longtime listeners of Bombshell will remember that we covered this actually in some of our earliest episodes. There was a catastrophic call with the Australian Prime Minister that got leaked that led to sort of a shift in how these calls were handled. But the Washington Post article highlights a handful of things that the president promised or suggested. In particular, he offered to help get Saudi Arabia into the G7. In case anybody was keeping score at home, that is definitely not what the G7 is about. He repeatedly fawned over President Putin and even more extraordinarily asked for his help in building a relationship with North Korea, which, I mean, I guess if that's what you want, I mean, Putin's a guy who could probably help you with that, but that would be a very unusual ask from an American head of state. And, you know, kind of reading through the article and sort of, you know, reading the comments from the, you know, anonymous staffers who are, you know, finally now like dishing dirt on what the hell happened on all these phone calls. It's not that difficult to imagine. I mean, basically, this is President Trump in every case, basically chatting up autocrats, trying to befriend them, trying to curry favor with them, trying to establish some sort of rapport by trading favors with them, not trading favors with Theresa May or Angela Merkel, instead of, you know, sticking to talking points and doing the thing that's supposed to, I don't know, advance U.S. national interests. And it just strikes me that's kind of consistent if you think of Trump fundamentally as the leader of a family business. He doesn't make any distinction between his personal interests and broader interests, right? So it's not like he ran a publicly traded company that had shareholders or was subject to oversight from the SEC or any sort of regulatory activity. And, you know, kind of seems to run the White House in a similar vein. I mean, he's a personalist. And so what's good for him is just what's good. And there's no distinction between, you know, those kinds of things.
Kind of amazing to me that they're still doing head of state calls.
That's a good point.
I mean, these aren't things that, like, I don't want to say this universally, but for the most part, head of state calls are ginned up because staff say we really need the president to either open up this opportunity for us or to close this deal for us or something. Like they have a purpose that doesn't come out of the president's head. And like, I could certainly see Trump saying, like, I want to call so-and-so. I'm sure that happens a lot. But others, like, there's some of them I look at, like, why on earth would staff say, like, let us please call this head of state in order to have it be completely screwed up in the outcomes, knowing the president doesn't read his talking points, knowing he doesn't pay attention to his read-ahead materials, and is not actually going to do what you want him to do at all. What's the point?
Yeah, I mean, I will say the other thing that I find just generally both confusing and distressing about this is this call with the Ukrainian president is the most extreme version of quid pro quo.
Right.
Well,
that we know of.
Right.
That we know of and produced a whistleblower. But like, there are definitely calls that I think we could call as inappropriate behavior. And there doesn't seem to have been a lot of like public, there doesn't seem to have been consternation or concern by very senior administration officials ever. Like, this is not like somebody, the Secretary of State is on a call and hears a quid pro quo and resigns in protest. This is not the Secretary of Defense or the chairman understands that there has been aid, which has been congressionally appropriated and authorized and notified, being held up for completely inappropriate political reasons and calling it out as part of his duty to the Constitution.
Nope, none of that's happening.
Let's all remember that General H.R. McMaster served in the Trump administration for over a year as National Security Advisor while in uniform. So not just as an appointee by the president, but as a commissioned officer of the United States of America. What obligations did he have that he did not fulfill? And that I would like to hear him talk a little bit more about this.
We're going to come back to this a little bit, but there's also a lot of sort of Sturm und Drang around the current NSC staff. Maybe some changes in sizing, maybe some changes in access. There's a lot of discussion around restrictions on access to these leader phone call transcripts and other sorts of things. Lauren, what should we be paying attention to as we look at the NSC staff itself?
Okay, so great question. So quick 101 on NSC staff that people have probably heard me say before, but the vast majority of NSC staff that work on substantive portfolios like Russia or counterterrorism or intelligence, they are detailees from other agencies, whether it be Department of State, Defense, the intelligence community, Treasury. They come from outside. There's some small portion of that staff, usually at the senior director level, the people who are running an office, who are political appointees or appointed by the president in some way. They're brought in from the outside. But in order to actually make the trains run on time, you actually have to have career professionals doing the work of writing talking points and listening to phone calls and managing meeting processes and things like that. So as of today, which is Sunday, there are new allegations out from Mark Zaid. Not allegations is the wrong word. There's a new announcement out from Mark Zaid that he is representing another whistleblower who is also apparently a detailee to the NSC staff from the intelligence community who has firsthand knowledge of one of the Ukraine calls. So that's that somebody would have firsthand knowledge of this call. We kind of talked about this earlier. Like, there's probably 10 people that were listening to this particular Ukraine call. There was probably more so than that, that received a summary and a transcript of that call. To have this sort of information floating around the NSC staff is pretty typical. Like, they are constrained to some degree, but it's useful to share transcripts and talking points and outcomes to people who are staffing the president so that you know how to follow up. So not surprisingly altogether, the president has looked at this and I assume thought to himself, we need to put limits on the NSC staff, both in terms of size and also access. If folks paid attention in the first year of the administration, they had already tried to limit the size. They'd also, to some degree, tried to limit the access in terms of papers that were circulating, access to meetings, access to phone calls. So this isn't new. They've been doing this for the last 2.5 years or so. What I will question in this case is how Robert O'Brien, the new National Security Advisor, actually starts to follow up on this recommendation by the president. Does he start actually kicking out NSC staff who are detailed over? There's about 300 of them right now. Does he keep them out of meetings or phone calls or off the computer systems that all the stuff would be stored altogether? If I was him, I would have a lot of thoughts about my own legal liability and be very cautious in how I followed up on this. But it's not surprising that the Trump administration would say we need to crack down on any possible leaks, which is something that they have easy opportunity to do. There's not rules about this. There's no rules that say these people have to be in meetings or that you have to have career NSC staff detailed over. They can kind of control the NSC staff however they want.
And also, as you noted, it's not like the president feels like he needs deep expertise and specific talking points to right. use for these calls or engagements, right? Like, he sees himself as a freewheeling deal maker. I'm gesticulating wildly while I say that.
His read-ahead materials come from Fox News, Fox and Friends in the Morning, which is, you know, maybe a more influential way to get to the president these days.
And it's not like there's a robust interagency process being driven. I mean, certainly there wasn't under Bolton. Whether McMaster was doing anything on that front is a little harder to tell. We talked last time about whether O'Brien would be trying to do that, you know, coordinate these things. But basically you have, I mean, essentially at this point, foreign policy being run by the president and Secretary Pompeo, and there is no real other coordination to be had. I mean, the policy statements or whatever the president treats that, you know, tweets that day. And no one, as far as I can tell, is doing really a deep dive or trying to manage a more underlying process to drive coherent outcomes or a coherent approach to on these other sorts of issues. So,
yeah, I mean, O'Brien just got started. He walked in into this exact mess, like just as he's began, the whistleblower commentary started coming out. So he's having to manage a policy process right in the middle of a major domestic political crisis in which domestic and foreign policy are totally intertwined and it's hard to separate it out.
So if we can shift gears slightly, I mentioned before that the president sort of, it's not surprising the president runs things, like his family business. And in many ways that has trappings of, you know, personalism. Kind of, if you think about, there's some political science language here that might be useful, but I think of him in many ways as like a personalist dictator. And so if we look at, I'm actually a comparativist by training. I think most people would think that I have a background in international security, which I do, but my actual PhD is in comparative politics. And that means that I love kind of unpacking different regime types and trying to understand the different ways in which countries govern themselves and sustain their legitimacy. And so one of the frameworks we can think about for this is comes from Barbara Geddes, among others. And we unpack different kinds of authoritarian models, so different kinds of non-democratic systems. We can think about military regimes, monarchies, party autocracies, and personalist dictatorships. And for the most part, I tend to think about the ways in which the president sees the world and sees his role in the current U.S. government through that personalist lens. But as I was kind of poking around on this, I was reminded one of a couple of things. One, that when I was going through graduate school in the early 2000s, we were really focused on transitions, as we were talking about before, from particularly post-Soviet states, but any kind of authoritarian transition through into democratic consolidation. And so Lynson Stepan and Guillermo O'Donnell and a lot of other folks really focusing on the emergence of those third wave democratic states, how they go from various kinds of autocratic beginnings and try to consolidate democracy. What we didn't talk a lot about at that time was democratic deconsolidation, right? Democratic backsliding. And I was reminded that there is a brilliant book from Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt called How Democracies Die. And I think it's one of those things that, probably seemed alarmist when it came out last year. And it's not focused on the U.S. per se. I mean, it's a deeply scholarly book about various democratic regimes around the world that have seen retrenchment into more authoritarian politics. But they have kind of a four-part test for identifying authoritarian leaders. And you guys can keep score at home on how these points strike you. But their four parts are: one, rejecting democratic institutions; two, denying the legitimacy of political opponents; three, tolerating or encouraging violence; and four, curtailing civil liberties. And I think one of the things that is most concerning, all of the drama that we've watched over the last, 10 days or 2 weeks, is the invitation of the president to target his political opponents for purely electoral reasons, right? And the idea that you would take institutions of foreign policy and national security and completely gum them up in your, kind of narrow domestic political concerns. I mean, that's an affront to basically all national security professionals. But it's really an indication of how Trump, I think, sees himself and sees the office, that there's no distinction. He doesn't really understand the broader pursuit of American national interests or the concept of a public good. He sees his narrow interests. And if I can make like one other plug, it's like the other book that would really help make sense of all of this is actually from sociology, and it's Diego Gambetta's Codes of the Underworld. He's a personalist dictator who grew up among mob bosses. And fundamentally, that's the kind of language that we see, the intimidation that we see, the coercion of his fellow, you know, high-level staffers, you know, getting all of these former generals to and current generals to do his bidding, has very clear undertones from kind of that, you know, that part of the world.
It's also just worth noting, I'm an economist, which we know, but, you know, a lot of the governance talk that we tend to focus on states tends to focus on state architecture, but like, non-governmental organizations actually have a lot of governance structure. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, it's really interesting to see the sort of U.S. governance structure put in light of a sort of structured, organized crime context, right? With a yep. mob boss and sort of inducements and quid pro quos and the use of sticks and carrots, right? All of which are also done on that side, but outside of our sort of democratic norms and democratic institutions.
So like the political economy of organized crime is the best. I love that world. And so a lot of what is intriguing and the parallel to it is so much of what goes on in essentially mob enforcement or drug cartel enforcement is about how do you enforce your deals when you can't pursue the formal justice system, right? You can't sue somebody for like not delivering your drugs or for, you know, not, you know, shaking down people properly. So there's this like selective application of violence, right? And this is the same thing, right? Trump can't like use the formal process to enforce his like weird conspiracy theories. And so he's, you know, appealing to violence and coercion in very similar ways because he can't use the formal system.
Right. And in fact, some might argue like the reason he's using foreign investigative apparatus is because he couldn't induce
Absolutely.
The U.S. domestic, right? Like that's kind of what that weird folder of fake White House Giuliani documents, which by the way, guys, I was on a plane and I landed and I checked my phone and I'm like, I'm sorry, what happened? But, you know,
that could have been any day last week.
Domestic agencies to investigate things. And so he's turned to foreign leaders. And it kind of makes you wonder this question of like, what happens when the president, you know, decides he doesn't care about democratic norms at all anymore. And Lauren, do you have nightmare scenarios for us?
I do, as a matter of fact. But on that point, I will say that it is in some ways a tiniest bit reassuring that if he is having to turn to foreign policy processes that are totally outside how things normally work in order to pursue his corrupt aims, that maybe the domestic institutions said like, no, this isn't going to work for us. We're not going to actually let you corrupt us in some way. So that's slightly reassuring. I don't know. Maybe.
I think they're holding on by a thread, but let's keep to it. All right. So you've kind of dug in on, you know, if we take this to the next level, we have a president with somewhat corrupt intent who seems to think of his interests and the institution's interests as one in the same, maybe not so committed to a variety of democratic norms, one of which could be the peaceful transfer of power. How do we think about that?
President Trump has already made fairly clear that he does that he's interested in the idea of staying past normal term limits, or that he would not necessarily respect an election that he did not win. So that publicly, without a lot of coercion, seems to be pretty much on his mind, and his followers seems to be very, very much in the same headspace. So I wanted to pose a couple scenarios to people that should, if not necessarily causes concern, that then we should be thinking about, as well as the Department of Defense should be thinking about in terms of how they might respond to this. So for one, let's say that it's November, President Trump loses the election. Many of his supporters, which do include militias and other folks who have heavily armed the United States, begin some sort of token, not terribly effective, armed uprising to demonstrate their unhappiness with the election. The president of the United States, if he wants to, can use the military to enforce calm, to enforce federal law, despite posse comitatus and what everyone thinks about it. He actually can use the military in instances to enforce federal law if that is what his if he chooses to exercise that authority. So that's one where you could see the military's involvement in a domestic political situation that kind of gums up the works in terms of who are they supporting. Is it the militia people? Is it the president? Is it the Constitution, otherwise, that could be easily manipulated by the media in some way. Second scenario that I pondered Let's say that there is an indeterminate winner, that we have to go to court, that there are recounts, that we kind of extend out beyond the election. The president starts to declare that he will not relinquish the role of commander in chief, that he is still in charge of the military, and he does not plan to give up that role. It's not like it's like a button that you hand over to your successor. This is more complicated than that. But that starts to raise questions about, if there's not a declared victor after the November 2020 election, how does the military react in such a scenario? Have they thought through this, and what would they actually, how would they respond? Third one is an obvious one, wag the dog. What if the president, after the election, declares war somewhere just to distract everybody? It's a great way to not only usurp the military, but also to get them interested in your, getting political leaders on their side in some form. And then the last one, which is also kind of interesting, is what if the president decides he wants to appoint a senior military advisor who is not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, which he can do. He can pick a military advisor from anywhere. He can bring them from out of uniform and say, you're my senior military advisor. I'm listening to you. It's not as though Milley is in the chain of command, and he can use that to come up with military advice and direction. So how does that sound? How are you guys feeling?
Great.
It feels extra great because we've only just talked about the military, but I was just passing reading an article about the Customs and Border Patrol concerns, and particularly how they're engaging with journalists coming in and out of the country. And it just reminded me that, like, there are actually a number of paramilitary organizations that are also under the president's control in a variety of ways too, that, you know, have like all sorts of issues and cultures that are distinct from the militaries. And it does make you wonder what happens if there are different approaches from different arms of our overall security sector.
Right. And it's important to note that in all of those cases I just mentioned, the U.S. military can have the absolute best of intentions, as well as the desire to serve the legal precedents and serve the Constitution. But every single one of those makes it just complicated enough that it's going to be tough to figure out, how do you publicly posture yourself and how do you serve the president of the United States in the way that they're supposed to? They have not run through scenarios in their mind of how this is going to work. And it's entirely possible that these could come to light over the next year or so in a way that, if I was General Milley or Secretary Esper, would want to be doing some serious thinking about.
But, like, I mean, imagine if that planning or discussions leak in any serious way. I mean, that it is an incredible, I mean, I feel for them, because that is an incredibly fraught thought experiment, no matter how much you do or do not document it, right? I mean, that is rough. We're going to take that as all food for thought and hopefully not have occasion to return to it in any great detail, but I think is the sort of thing that would be, you know, if you're kind of inclined to do indicators and warning, those would each be some pieces that you would want to keep eyes on. Anything we have to kind of wrap up this particular bit of White House mayhem? I have to say, I expect that we will continue covering this topic, and we'll have some decisions to make about how this particular podcast wants to engage with both the impeachment proceedings as they develop or mature, but also the president's actions in the face of that. The whole episode could be White House mayhem. In some ways, it is.
I did want to have one closing point, which is not related to the substance here, but which, you know, as we've talked in a lot of these, there are a lot of civil servants and a lot of junior folks who end up inadvertently getting caught up in these complicated issues, that have knowledge of working on, you know, in the course of their daily jobs, end up having knowledge of this and end up having to need private counsel or information on how they best deal with Congress. Lauren helpfully retweeted some questions I had on this, and there are a couple of good threads that we both retweeted in there. But the TLDR is, if you have questions, there are attorneys and attorneys with pro bono, at least initial advising services, that can help you figure out how to navigate the system. And it's just worth, I know we have listeners in that category, so just worth folks knowing, and knowing you can get that information quietly by just searching on our Twitter threads.
And we'll include that in the show notes as well.
I'll close by noting that, as you've seen from the show, we're not doing the play-by-play of the impeachment hearings or investigation or of the Ukraine investigation, but hoping to provide some context that is beyond that. But if you do want the play-by-play, our friends at Lawfare and Rational Security are doing a splendid job, as always.
Probably not sleeping.
No.
But excellent coverage.
They are the heroes we deserve. So a quick review of pop culture to get folks off on a lighter note.
Guys, there's a show. It's called Perfect Harmony. It is like Heart of Dixie meets West Wing style snappy dialogue meets Glee with like singing. It has Bradley Whitford. It has Anna Camp, who you might also know as Aubrey from Pitch Perfect. Like, it's just, it's everything you need when you don't want to know about what's happening in the world and you just want to watch something else. It's great.
If you ever wondered if what would happen if Josh Lyman was in fact a musical theater director or a pedantic choir director, this is the show for you.
We didn't mention this in our prep, but Mara Jade, as we talked about a few months ago, has now been brought back into the Star Wars canon.
I don't know. I heard that was maybe a spoof. So
really,
yeah,
really,
I'm disappointed.
Don't break my heart.
Sorry,
don't break my
heart. I know. But on the plus side, The Good Place is back for its final season. And if folks have not been watching The Good Place, then they're really missing out because they miss all the references to The Bad Place. And let me tell you that there's a lot of room for Bad Place memes throughout our lives right now. But The Good Place is fantastic. It's basically an existential comedy, which you don't get very often in the world. And Kirsten Bell remains hilarious. Ted Danson's really quite something. And Darcy Carden is basically God's gift to America at the moment. So we are huge fans of any escapist television or pop culture that you might find. And we'll be back here in another couple weeks to try to help everyone through what happens next. Thanks.